You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On the programme today, the G7 Summit. Yesterday, we asked what it's all for and what it can achieve. Today, we might have an answer. They've reached an agreement on climate change, which even campaigners believe is a big step in the right direction.
We have clearly said as the G7 that we need binding rules at the heart of the climate agreement. The world doesn't have any binding rules at the moment, and therefore that must be a goal in Paris.
Angela Merkel there. We'll hear from Isabel Hilton and Roger Boys on whether cutting out fossil fuels in the next 85 years is realistic. Also coming up, Egypt summons the US ambassador about meetings with the Muslim Brotherhood taking place on US soil. We'll ask, is there any safe location across the globe to be part of the now outlawed political group? And as the fallout of the Turkish election begins to take shape, we'll get the latest on the AKP's scramble to form a coalition government, which so far seems to be falling on deaf ears. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Roger Boys, diplomatic editor of The Times, and Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. Roger and Isabel, welcome to you both. We begin tonight with the G7 summit, which wrapped up at the Regal Schloss Elmau in Bavaria earlier today. Yesterday on this programme, we were inquiring what the meeting of the world's most exclusive club of well-to-do nations gets up to during meetings behind closed doors. It seems we might have been slightly premature because we perhaps now have an answer. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has led a climate-focused agenda and agreements to cut out the use of fossil fuels by the end of the century have been announced, as well as more pressing deadlines for Greece's economic future and a resolution to maintain pressure on Russia over the Ukraine conflict. We can talk about all these things, Roger, but overall, do you think the summit has been sort of seen as a bit of a success?
Well, yes, I think the emphasis on bit, really. If you look at any prediction you could have made in 1915 for the year 2000, I think you would be pretty much, you'd pretty much come adrift, would you not? I mean, you'd miss out a world war, you'd miss out the rise of the auto industry, you'd miss out the Holocaust, you'd miss out all sorts of things. And it's the same here, that this is an incredibly vague goal that's been achieved, but people are hailing it. And a lot of the people who were demonstrating against them are hailing it as a goal. And it does seem to me to contain lots of little footnotes, like what about the nuclear industry that these people are also protesting about? Does seem to me that any kind of goal like this will lead to a complete surge in nuclear developments. The nitty gritty is being done elsewhere and there in Bonn at the moment. And there it's quite clear where the differences are. The differences are there where they've always been, which is between rich countries and poorer countries, countries that are growing faster and countries that are not. And countries, and this was also discussed, I think, in Elmau, countries that are particularly fragile, countries that are particularly vulnerable to climate change. I mean, it's not just the Maldives, yeah? There are lots and lots of countries that actually are already beginning to suffer from climate change. And they did, you've got to give them credit, they did think about that and they thought about it. But apart from thinking about it and those grand words and those grand photo opportunities, I'm not sure that much more really emerged from the climate change business. There's plenty of little sideshows where things were discussed. I mean, a task force on Ebola and similar epidemics. You know, there's a kind of lot of little good, useful bits of business that were done, whether it was worth the whole circus, I'm not so sure. But either way, it got lots of little bits of business got done. But that grand target, I don't believe it. I'm speaking as someone who almost got killed by an electric car, by the way, about an hour ago. So these silent killers.
Okay, I'm detecting a hint of bitterness.
Yes.
There. Isabel, I mean, aside from the photo ops and wow, what photo ops, I'm sure we'll be using those for years. On the climate issue, I mean, as Roger says, it's a bit vague. It's 85 years in the distance, you know, part of this target. But then a lot of these targets have to be quite far in ahead, don't they?
It's a long way ahead, but you are talking about the complete decarbonisation of the global economy, and that is a huge task. And actually, to have that declaration is very important because it's really the first time that they've said that. They've said it's the end of the fossil fuel age. And that deals with a whole bunch of stuff which has slowed down this process. Resistance from obviously vested interests, you know, challenges to the science, gone really. Because if these people say this is the end of the fossil fuel age, then it will happen.
Now, are you surprised by that, that they've gone that far to
say
that?
Well, I'm encouraged by it, I have to say. I mean, it's been clear that Merkel and Obama have been very committed to this, and it's one of the things that Obama wants to leave as his legacy, despite the fact that he has kind of very vigorous rearguard action to deal with at home. But he's, you know, perhaps belatedly, I wish he'd done it in Copenhagen, but he's done it now, and that's hugely important. Meanwhile, you've got China racing for it with, you know, ever-increasing speed. Germany, actually, Roger, has committed to phasing out nuclear as well. So certainly in the case of Europe's biggest industrial economy, a transition to non-fossil energy will not necessarily mean a surge in nuclear. China certainly is building more nuclear. But last year, there was the investments in renewable energy were greater than the investments in fossil fuels. So all over the place, you can see, you know, in the landscape, you can see a big transition happening, and a political endorsement of this was very important for Bonn, which is very important for Paris. And a lot of getting a deal is about mood music. It's about how people feel, whether they think it's really shifting or whether they're just going to go on digging their heels in and extracting the maximum small concession. That's important.
Of course, Paris is the big meeting at the end of the year where it's hoped there's going to be an agreement. Roger, you know, you were based in Germany for a number of years, and now look, perhaps, you know, this was on a very sunny, very windy day, but last year there was a day when half of all Germany's energy came from renewables. So Germany is a country that does understand the potential power of renewable energy, isn't it?
Yes. I wouldn't set necessarily. I mean, you know, Angela Merkel won't continue forever. I mean, the commitment to withdrawing from nuclear is not as firmly established as one might think. So I think that, despite what Isabel says, I think they might flick back at some stage. We'll have to see after the 2017 election. Yes, there have been, of course, they subsidized heavily both wind and solar power to much criticism, I must say, because it distorted the market somewhat, and gave massive tax subsidies to people to put solar panels on their roofs, and that worked. It has changed people's minds. It's helped that the coal lobby, which was always not Helmut Kohl but the black stuff, has been shrinking in Germany. It was always powerful within the Social Democratic Party. Now it's not. Brown coal is disappearing. It's not really mined all that intensely anymore in eastern Germany. So all these things, this mix is changing for her benefit. And of course, globally, fracking changes the calculation in all sorts of things as well. So you have slower growth in China. You have other factors. So actually, one could be, I think, kind of slightly optimistic in the short term, that's to say for the next decade or so, something, you know, there might be some kind of mini tipping point which Germany has shown the way for. That's true. But, you know, 85 years is an awful long time. And lots can change. And when you look at, oil producers like Russia, who are betting the whole house really on Arctic exploration and developing oil resources there, you have to think, well, what's going to happen next? You know?
Right, but Russia and Saudi Arabia, and they are obviously going to fight, you know, for the last drop of oil. Mm. But it's not just small island states that are vulnerable to climate change. California has just had a historic drought. California produces 40% of Americans' food. You know, things like Katrina, things like Superstorm Sandy have changed the way people feel about vulnerability. And I think that the shift in the American perception, the US perception of its own vulnerability is pretty important. So it's not just, let's be nice to Vanuatu. It's, oops, what's going to happen the next time something like that hits the East Coast?
And do you also, Isabel, get the sense that, you know, it's not just that the mood music has changed, that, you know, you've had this, you know, quite grand statement here. You've also had, of course, that deal between the US and China last year on cutting emissions. You know, the first time that anything like that has really happened.
Absolutely.
It suggests that this is building up to something at the end of the year in Paris, which could be quite dramatic.
I think there's a terrific momentum, actually. Whatever the deal says, and you know, action will go on beyond the deal. China is preparing its 13th plan. The betting now is that China's emissions will probably peak around 2022, 2025. That's pretty early. The question then is how fast they come down. But China's really has a lot of momentum. The 13th plan is going to be quite dramatic. China's brought down the cost of solar panels to, you know, below the cost of fossil fuels now. So actually, you do have a sense that the snowball is really beginning to roll.
Roger, this was the G7, not the G8, because Vladimir Putin has been, I think, temporarily uninvited for the foreseeable. Do you think the fact that it was now, you know, seven countries round the table again, who, you know, all within their certain contexts seem to get on and sort of see the world in roughly the same sort of way, actually made this a more sort of a convivial, collegial summit?
Well, yes, I suppose so. I mean, it helps redefine the West, I suppose. It helps redefine Western values. I mean, you know, it was very important for the European Union participants to talk again to Obama because about sanctions against Putin, because, frankly, they're not at all on the same hymn sheet. And so they played, you know, they played unity up quite extensively. But of course, you know, Canada and Japan also have things to say about Russia and are also acting against Russia. So a kind of Western consensus, which was more or less there before, but it congealed properly in this situation where Putin's not there. They can all bitch about him extraordinarily, and I think they probably did. So it's good. It's still complex about, I think there's still a fundamental philosophical agreement between America, which thinks, because, you know, they sit down and say, well, sanctions not working because Putin's behavior is not changing, to which the Americans say, well, sanctions have to be stronger. And they have all sorts of things up their sleeve, which will probably come to pass. And then parts of the EU who say, well, they're not working and it's doing us harm. What the heck are we doing? You know, let's go back to some kind of negotiated settlement, because in the end, we're going to have to surrender Ukraine or parts of it. And then other bits of the European Union who say, no, we have to keep unity within the European Union, not strengthen sanctions. So there's kind of, but keep them intact. So there's kind of three views. So it's not, so there isn't really a coherent Western position, but G7, you know, in the Sound of Music kind of context, does allow you to pretend there is.
And, you know, pretending is, I guess, at least a big part of it. Isabel, is there a danger, though, that the West sort of reassures itself? Because you know, we all like diplomacy when we're talking to people that we like and we, on the whole, get on with, and there's a sort of relationship there, and we can come together and say, oh, actually, yeah, here are the things that we agree about, and we've got a common enemy maybe here. It's a lot harder when it is, you know, say the G8 and Russia's there, or it's the G20 and there's lots of other countries there with their own agendas. Or, of course, it's the UN Security Council and you've got Russia and China right there. You know, the voices are equally as important, and it's a lot harder to find that sort of harmony that we've perhaps seen in Germany this week.
Well, I think that's true, but I think it's also an argument for diplomacy rather than against it. You know, the only thing worse than meetings where people disagree is not having meetings at all. And there's still a lot to be said for the premise that George Orwell is better than war, without meetings, without these encounters, and without the search for whatever bits of any agenda you can agree on. Things deteriorate faster and further. Although it's easy to look at all these meetings and say, so what did they achieve? And even many of them are just kicking cans down the road a lot of the time. I still think it's better that they happen.
I want to stick on the subject of diplomacy because the Egyptian authorities have summoned the US ambassador in Cairo in for a meeting over supposed meetings between the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, of course, outlawed in Egypt, and US officials, which took place not in Egypt, Roger Boys, but in Washington. Now, we're used to, you know, ambassadors being called in by foreign ministries to be given a bit of a talking to. Is it sort of like rung two on that sort of list of sort of escalating things you can do to an ambassador in terms of relations? Sort of, you know, we'll call him in and we'll have a good chat. But it's interesting, isn't it, that Egypt is not angry with what the US ambassador has done inside the country, but seems to think that they can have a go at the US for what the US is doing in its own country. Does that surprise you?
Well, not really. No, it happens, as Isabel can no doubt tell you. I mean, any time any Western leader meets the Dalai Lama, the ambassador gets called in Beijing, whoever it happens to be. And punishment ensues quite often. There is this Dalai Lama effect, isn't there, where trade more or less collapses for about 18 months and then you're forgiven. well, I don't know. I mean, Isabel's the expert on this. But nevertheless, the difference between China doing that, actually the parallel is more like Reagan meeting solidarity people when they were an underground movement in Poland, for example. Again, the American chargé would be called in by Jaruzelski's team. You know, it's that kind of pattern. But the difference between, Dalai Lama reprimands and this is actually, China can do something about it, and in fact, Egypt is a supplicant country. It's actually receiving masses of subsidies. Its army is receiving masses of subsidies from the United States, and it's therefore almost by definition an act of theatre. But what is interesting is the broader context, which is that it seems that we do need Sisi, General Field Marshal, whatever he is, President Sisi, more and more in the way things are shaping up in the Middle East. So, you know, the ambassador goes in, he gets ticked off, and the natural reflex when he sends the cable to the State Department would be, yeah, but, you know, so what kind of thing. But actually, it does have a little bit of an impact because the West needs Sisi in dealing with Gaza, dealing with Hamas, dealing with Middle East peace, and dealing with Libya, and actually in all sorts of different scenarios now. Egypt is becoming more important, but it's not as important as it thinks.
Isabel, we've had a bigger sort of comment on this of the importance of Sisi this week with Donald Rumsfeld lauding Sisi saying how important he is and that he's trying to make progress. And there is a certain type of thinking amongst not just neoconservatives in the US, but as Roger's saying, within sort of other parts of, you know, Western establishment, that actually, you know, to reuse an old phrase, this is a man that we can do business with and that we should be doing business with.
That's the same Donald Rumsfeld that made such a success of the Middle East, of course. So, look, I think we've seen a lot of this kind of posturing from enemies of Obama over Obama's Middle East policy. And I think that's just something we have to live with. There isn't a great record of, you know, the men, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch school of diplomacy. It tends to go wrong in the end. And I think, Sisi, this is just one of a long list of rather kind of calculated insults to the United States, which are, as Roger says, this is a supplicant country. It may think itself a very important supplicant country, but it doesn't argue very cogently for its diplomatic skills that it feels that this is a useful thing to do. I mean, as far as rebukes to ambassadors go, as Roger says, this is absolutely routine when the Dalai Lama kind of, you know, any whiff of maroon and you know, the Chinese are jumping up and down. In fact, the last time he was in the United Kingdom, the Chinese diplomats went round Scottish local councils urging them, you know, to refuse. It's amazing the lengths that they would go to.
Who knew that if a councillor officials from Dundee met the Dalai Lama, that would be an issue?
Well, indeed. As far as the sanctions go, though, the Chinese are actually pretty hard-headed. What happened the last time Cameron met the Dalai Lama was that he was locked out for 18 months. Trade continued without a ripple, I have to say. The levels of trade did not diminish at all, which might be an argument for prime ministers not being salesmen, frankly, and concentrating on the political relationship rather more than trying to sell bits of Britain to likely foreign buyers.
Isabel Hilton and Roger Boys, thank you both. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
Top ingredients, world-class service, less foam and pretension, and honest food made with dedication. Monocle focuses on what we think really matters and launches the Monocle Restaurant Awards. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 to hear of the places we value highly, where we want to dine again and again, and where most restaurant ranking lists may not guide you to.
What does it look like? What is the vitality of this place on the street? And yes, the food has to be outstanding as well, but there are many other elements that go beyond that.
The nominees will be announced every Friday on our food and drink program, The Menu, and the winner will be announced in July. Don't miss out. Tune into The Menu every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
£18.22 here in London, at £13.22 in New York City. To Turkey now. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AKP, Justice Party, is licking its wounds after a substantial knock in Sunday's general election, which saw them lose their majority hold on the government for the first time in 13 years. Today, the party's predicament is becoming more apparent. Nobody wants to form a coalition with the AKP, especially not the leader of Turkey's pro-Kurdish party, Selahattin Demirtas of the HDP. Roger Boys, it's no wonder that no one wants to form a coalition with the AKP when they've spent their time dismissing their opponents as traitors or linked to terrorists or somehow not quite Turkish.
Well, with the exception of the Nationalist Party, the MHP, which looks as if it could be the logical coalition partner. It's not going to give them a massive, top-thumping majority, but it could be that that's what the shape of the future government is. The problem with that only is that they're so virulently anti-Kurd that Erdogan's cautious kind of peacemaking with the PKK and with the Kurds will drop. So I think we have to, in terms of what worries us most, that's to say us, we non-Turks, probably that would be the most worrisome outcome. That's to say an ambitious, aggressive rather frustrated president, a prime minister who is struggling to show that he's not a puppet, in coalition with a right-wing party that wants to undo one of Erdogan's projects. And it seems to me that that doesn't spell chaos, but it spells massive tensions and can only really in the end lead to a breakup of that coalition and either minority government or almost certainly new and early elections, where Erdogan will try and get the result that he thinks he deserves.
Isabel Hilton, lots of people had been talking about their concern that Turkey was becoming more authoritarian, that Erdogan obviously had this desire to change the constitution to create a stronger, more powerful presidency, which of course he hoped that he would then hold. The fact that that hasn't happened, despite the possibilities of uncertainty and chaos that Roger just outlined there, for many Democrats, I'd say that with a small D, that's what's happened now seems like in some ways quite an interesting result.
Well, I think it's a highly positive result. Actually, it's always a bad sign when an incumbent coming, after quite a long period in office, as he'd had, wants to change the constitution to consolidate his position. We know where that's headed. And I think the disappointing thing about Erdogan, who after all began, I think, with the image of, here was a Muslim leader of a majority Muslim country, even if a secular state.
And let's not forget also, he was fighting against the military for a very long time.
Absolutely.
To actually establish a proper democracy.
Indeed,
in Turkey.
He was. And it seemed as though he could be a model of a kind of moderate Muslim statesman who would be the kind of person we could do business with. So it was unfortunate, I think, that that after 14 years he was moving very much in the wrong direction. And I think very encouraging that the Turkish voters have also rejected that, because I don't think that was clear to me at any event, in any event, that given the polarization of the world around them, that they would necessarily opt for a less religiously inclined state. But that has apparently been very profound in Turkey, and they've held on to it.
Also encouraging, of course, that the vote wasn't rigged, which is actually something that some analysts had sort of built into the calculation, because when you've got a party that needs 10%, precisely 10% to get into parliament, it doesn't take that, and the opinion polls have got massive room for error, it doesn't take much to push it below 10%, and they didn't do that, and that's good.
That party you mentioned that got just over 10%, in fact, maybe even 12% in the end, the HDP, Isabel Hilton, they are a pro-Kurdish party. They were seen before as a Kurdish party, but they tried to appeal to be more of a secular, liberal, leftist party. Absolutely. And it seems that that's actually where the protesters from Gezi Park have actually ended up, if they voted at all, have ended up with, in that party or supporting that party, which suggests that, unlike other parts of that region where it's been difficult to lead from being in a square to actually, pushing a party, that step might have been made in Turkey.
Well, I think the election certainly presented an opportunity for those people who were in the square, because it became, in effect, a referendum on Erdogan. And these the surge in, if you like, the vote for a left-wing party would certainly reflect the opinion in the square. So an opportunity presented itself. And it's not, I think, that the square created the opportunity, but the election and what was on the table around the election certainly mobilised them.
Roger, very briefly, because we've only got 20 seconds left, but Turkey and the EU, is there more that the EU can now do to try and draw Turkey back towards them?
Well, it can certainly encourage. I happen to think this HEP is going to become an instrument of change. It links discontented metropolitan Turkey with the Kurds, and it represents a young generation, and we should do everything we can to encourage it.
More women too.
There we are. Mm-hmm. Isabel Hilton and Roger Boys, thank you both very much indeed. That was Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mariana Zuniga. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Daniel Giacopelli's next. Then it's Section D with Josh Fennett. I will be back at the same time tomorrow. That is 1800 hours here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.